This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. In the years following 1917 and the establishment of the Soviet Union in 1922, the leaders of the revolution sought to industrialize and modernize with extraordinary speed. Berkeley historian Yuri Sleskin examines the era following the Russian Revolution through one building that housed many of the revolutionaries in his new book, The House of Government, A Saga of the Russian Revolution. It's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm pleased it brings Professor Sleskin to our show. Professor, I don't speak Russian. Say your last name in Russian.
Sleskin.
Okay, I will never get that. But you told me to pronounce it Sleskin, so thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So your book includes a disclaimer. The disclaimer is, this is a work of history. Any resemblance to fictional characters, dead or alive, is entirely coincidental. Does the history of the Russian Revolution read fiction, perhaps like Russian fiction?
Well, that was my idea. Or rather, that's how the book came together. I started out trying to write a history book, and I ended up writing a history book that is structured like a novel.
Mm-hmm. So there was an actual building.
Yes, it's still there.
A house of government. Tell us about it. And as you said, it's still there.
It's still there. It was built in the late 20s, early 30s. It was officially known as the House of Government. It housed some of the top members of Soviet political and cultural elite. It contained 505 apartments. About 2,500 or so residents altogether, which means about 700 actual revolutionaries, Bolshevik officials, party state officials, and the rest their family members. And it was also a prototype for communist domesticity of the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it remained this one building, and it's still there today, diagonally across the river from the Kremlin.
So you said that this is where the party elite lived. How does one get into this building? I mean, there are a lot more, I would assume, a lot more people in the party who can fit in that building. So how does one get into that building?
One had to be a people's commissar, which is to say a minister of the Soviet government, deputy commissar, a Red Army commander, a particularly prominent poet, or someone close to the throne, as it were, to the Kremlin. In some way. For example, the professor who embalmed Lenin's body lived there, the person who composed the Soviet national anthem lived there, the architect who built that building and was in the 1930s in the process of building what he considered the ultimate public building of all time, the Palace of Soviets across the river, was living there as well. Hundreds of people at the very top, or rather very close to the very top, because the person at the top, Comrade Stalin, remained in the Kremlin mm-hmm. across the river.
So, as you said, this is meant to be, I guess, sort of the ideal setting for domestic life.
Right.
How did communists imagine domestic life, and was it different from the way they viewed it in the West, the way it is with capitalist domestic life, what they thought that would be?
That is one of the book's central themes and one of the Bolsheviks' central problems. They did not really know how to imagine domestic life under communism. They didn't have any guidance from Marx or Engels or Lenin, or almost any. And so they improvised. For a while, they argued about it, and then they stopped talking about it until the time came for them to confess their guilt to the secret police. What one thing they knew is that humans needed leisure, a great deal of leisure. And that leisure could be subdivided into certain activities. And so they tried to provide as many separate spaces within that building as there were activities they could name and imagine. So there was a clinic there, a theater, a movie theater, a tennis court, a volleyball court, rooms for playing chess, for symphony orchestra rehearsals, shooting ranges, a solarium, as well as a bank, grocery store, beauty salon, and so on. But one place they had little to say about was family apartments. They weren't even sure that families needed apartments. They weren't sure that communists needed families. Because the family as an institution interferes with universal brotherhood. Mm-hmm. You, in any family, any parent, tends to prefer his or her offspring to those of others.
Right.
And that posed a problem. It was understood to be a problem. It was not clear, however, what to do about it. The scripture, so to speak, did not contain any answers. And so those apartments became puzzling, bewildering spaces for the Bolsheviks who were thinking about such things and for the Bolsheviks who lived in that house.
Well, I want to ask you about the religious nature of Bolshevik life, but why worry about altering domestic life at all? Or does it go back to this notion that there's no need for domestic life?
Well, because communism was about abolishing inequality. Inequality stems from class hierarchies, as far as a good Marxist is concerned. But it is also present in families. It's everywhere. And the kind of inequality one finds in families seems, it may not be primary, if you're a Marxist, it may not be the most important kind, but it seems very difficult to eradicate. If you may legislate all sorts of equality, but it's very hard to legislate the absence of discrimination within the home, which is to say you discriminate in favor of your wife relative to all the other eligible women. You discriminate as a matter of course on a daily basis in favor of your children as opposed to those of others, and so on. And many Bolsheviks thought about this, talked about this, but virtually none had many ideas to offer as to how to deal with it.
I'm speaking with Yuri Slezkin about his new book, The House of Government, A Saga of the Russian Revolution. Now, you argue that the Bolsheviks were a millenarian apocalyptic sect. For those of us, myself included, who are not historians or scholars, what does that mean?
Millenarianism means waiting for the millennium, for a perfect society, for some kind of bliss. A millenarian is somebody who doesn't just wait for it to come, but expects it in his or her lifetime. Usually as a result of a violent cataclysm, which is to say, an apocalypse. So an apocalyptic millenarian is somebody who is convinced that this tremendous cataclysm is going to happen in their lifetime, leading eventually and imminently to whatever you call this, paradise, the kingdom of the Lord, communism, whatever. So early Christianity was a millenarian movement. Jim Jones and the People's Temple was a millenarian movement. The Mormons early on were millenarians. Many others were.
Given conditions in Russia under the Tsars and with World War I, was millenarian thinking common in Russia?
It was exceedingly common at the turn of the 20th century. There was a sense of loss, of disorientation, of sort of having lost one's bearings, and the place was full of doomsday preachers, apocalyptic prophets, teachers talking about the coming millennium, and so on. So this time, the turn of the 20th century in the Russian Empire was sort of structurally very similar to Palestine at the time of Jesus. To some degree, you could say, United States in the 1960s, and certainly Russia again in the 1990s.
I was going to ask you, are we seeing a rise in millenarian thinking now? Are there parallels with trends 100 years ago?
Of course, of course. We've all heard about, seen, perhaps discussed evangelical Christian millenarianism, but still very common in this country. Not as common as it used to be during the first and second Great Awakenings, but still common. And of course, within Islam, a tradition very rich in millenarian enthusiasms, as rich as Christianity, we are now witnessing a major explosion of millenarian thinking and millenarian action.
What did Bolshevism say about existing an organized religion? Because we're talking about Bolsheviks and we're talking about people with millenarian thinking, but there's organized religion in Russia. What's going on with that?
Well, they thought of it as obsolete, as something that was not going to last much longer, that perhaps needed to be helped to disappear, but that something that was on its, for the most part, on its last legs. The Bolsheviks tended to worry about their bourgeois capitalist enemies, visible and hidden, much more than they did about things they called religion, because they considered religion passé.
Did they consider what they were doing to be religious in any way? I mean, we've spent this whole time talking about them with religious language, and yet they didn't view themselves
not.
That way.
Of course not. No, they did not. Indeed, the use of the term religion helped them separate themselves from all those other kinds of millenarianism and all sorts of other faiths. Because by calling all those other things religion and calling themselves an ideal, or calling what they believed in an ideology or a prediction, they drew a very stark line between what they considered real, which is to say what they were doing, and what they saw as a chimera, which is what Christians, Muslims, religious Jews, and others believed in. But as far as I'm concerned, that line is not very stark. And if one considers certain questions, not there at all.
So you write that revolution was inseparable from love. Revolution and love? And even in your New York Times op-ed that I read, there are a lot of characters, real people involved mm-hmm. in the op-ed, and there are a lot of relationships, married people, people not married to each other, people leaving each other and coming back to each other, and love and revolution are one in all of this. What is the connection here?
It's true that my book is not primarily about millenarianism. It is important in order to understand the frame, the world in which the Bolsheviks lived, but it is primarily about individuals, human beings, relationships, families, love, adultery, child rearing, and so on. And the question is how those two, and that was the first question you asked, how those two relate to each other, right? Individual life and those grand beliefs. So the connection is that, like most sects, certainly most apocalyptic sects, the Bolsheviks early on were primarily a man's movement. Most leaders, indeed most members, the overwhelming majority of the members of the early Bolshevik party were men. Moreover, they were very young men. Again, something that's typical of new sects, mm-hmm. particularly millenarian sects. Many of them were young men in love with young women. And they associated their hope, their belief, their anticipation, expectation, their imagining of that new world to come, communism, with their own youth and with their love for another human being. And so many of the stories of the original Bolsheviks are stories of thinking about love and about revolution and communism in parallel at the same time. And my story is about the collapse of both and the perception that both end in betrayal. And of course, that's what most of my characters are arrested and executed for in the end, their alleged betrayal of the revolution. And that's what many of them thought about when they fell out of love, grew older, abandoned some of their ideals, and stopped worrying about the lack of inequality in their own lives.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Yuri Sleskin, professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is The House of Government, A Saga of the Russian Revolution. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. And this is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking with Yuri Sleskin. He is the author of The House of Government, A Saga of the Russian Revolution. Before we went to break, we talked about the relationship between love and revolution in Bolshevik Russia, and how this House of Government is the scene of all of this. Mayakovsky, he was a poet. He figures prominently, if memory serves, in the op-ed that you wrote in the Times. He was also all of these young men are rather romantic. And remind me, is he the one who reads from the book Victoria? I'm trying to remember. He got so impassioned.
There was two others.
Two other people?
Two other characters mentioned in that op-ed.
Okay.
But he's part of that world, for sure.
So talk about Mayakovsky. He loved a woman named Maria.
Right.
Right. And he ends up committing suicide. But before he did that, she wrote to him about moral murder at home. Moral murder. What does she mean by that?
I don't know exactly what she meant, because that letter is all I have, really, mm-hmm. Or almost all I have about her relationship with her husband. But I do have some letters that she and her husband had exchanged earlier on. And so apparently what she meant was that she was unable to be herself, to be the kind of revolutionary that her husband was recognized as being, and she was writing to Mayakovsky asking for help. She was a sculptor, he was a poet, she was the hero, the subject of one of his greatest early love poems, and she would at the end of her life also commit suicide. Mm-hmm. Mayakovsky never lived in the House of Government. Mm-hmm. She did, because of her husband. And this is, I think, the answer to your question, is that of those about 700 officials who were assigned to particular apartments within the House of Government, there were almost no women. Bolshevism, in other words, there were lots of women living in those apartments, but they were living there as family members, as wives, daughters, mothers of the Bolsheviks who were entitled to apartments in that building. So not only was the Bolshevik Party a man's organization, but the revolution as a whole was, the main actors tended to be men, and many of the women who were passionate at being revolutionaries felt morally murdered at home.
So they didn't feel like they were a part of, well, let me ask you the question. Did they not feel that they were a part of the revolution that was swirling around them, that their husbands and lovers were actively involved in? They were just spectators.
They weren't spectators. They were active participants.
The women.
Yes, but they were not among the leaders. They were not among those who would be entitled to living in the house of government in their own right. So there were perhaps as many, or almost as many, female revolutionaries, passionate, enthusiastic revolutionaries, as there were men. But they were really not anywhere close to the top. The Bolshevik leadership was entirely male. The Bolshevik party state hierarchy was filled almost exclusively with men. Women, female communists, had certain important roles to play, but those were primarily secondary roles in the sort of the basic political sense, as well as in terms of cultural politics.
I'm sort of here struggling with the notion behind the House of Government, if it's meant to be a community where there are no walls, everyone is there for the collective good, and yet there they are living in apartments, where they're living in families, where they're trying to restructure domestic life, yet in the cause of doing that, they're living a structured domestic life that they seem to be desperately trying to get away from, to deconstruct. Was this House of Government doomed to fail?
It's a very good question, and it's a very good description of one of the book's major themes. In some ways, I think it was doomed to fail. Partly, again, because the Bolsheviks had no guidance as to what to do inside that house. Partly, arguably, because any radical assault on the family is doomed, or perhaps is doomed. And it is also true, as you suggest, that the Bolsheviks did not build a communal house for themselves. There had been some experiments in communal living, dorms for officials of both sexes, with their children, if they had any, living elsewhere, raised by professionals, and so on. The top Bolsheviks built a very different house for themselves, as I say, with lots of spaces, public spaces for different kinds of leisure, and then those family apartments that remained opaque to the party and to the ideology, and remained a mystery to them, because they weren't sure what it meant to be a good communist at home. How was a good communist husband or father or wife supposed to act at home, behind those walls? And so that really goes to the, and how are they to raise their children? And so that's where some of the most important questions are for my book, and I think some of the most dramatic stories about certain people living inside that building.
And so then, what did the children of the Bolsheviks think of the revolution and of their parents' work? Because as people are getting older, they learn other things, their children grow up. Do they share the revolutionary fervor? Do their parents continue to share the same revolutionary fervor that brought them into the House of Government to begin with?
The general answer to your last question is that no, they tried desperately, the parents' generation, the parents, to maintain their faith and the pitch of their expectation and belief, but they couldn't, partly because they were growing older. And as older men with wives and children and secret lovers, they couldn't love the revolution and love that young woman who represented and perhaps embodied it as much as they did when they were 19 or 16 when they joined that sect. which they call the party of a new type. And so at home, they raised boys and girls, later men and women, who would love the memory of their parents, who loved their country, loved socialism, admired their parents who had made the revolution, but who were not Bolsheviks themselves, who were not millenarians or apocalyptics in the way they saw the world, carried themselves, behaved themselves. Most sects, most millenarians, are one-generation affairs. If you think about, they either kill themselves or try to kill the world and perish in the process. Very few, such as Christianity, Islam, Mormonism, bridge that gap, pass that faith on to their children and their children's children, in spite of the apparent failure of the original prophecy. The Bolsheviks couldn't do it, and one of the reasons they couldn't do it was hidden inside their homes.
It was inside their apartments.
Those apartments inside that building and many other buildings.
Isn't it? It's kind of ironic that a movement, the Bolsheviks, who thought of themselves as trying to do away with, supplant religion, could not outlive the religions that they were trying to supplant. So Stalin. Under Stalin, there was a Great Purge. There was the Great Terror from 36 to 38, 39. Mm-hmm. How many of the residents of the House of Government were among those in prison or executed?
Well, about 800 were kicked out of the house and either sent to prison or into exile. Some of them executed. Most of the men, of those who actually had apartments assigned to them, ended up being executed. Most of the women were sent into exile. Their children would remember their men, their fathers, as self-sacrificial revolutionaries, unjustly murdered by a brutal tyrant. They would tend to think differently of their mothers, who would come back after about 8 years in exile as aged, sick, lost women who were not needed or wanted by their children or apparently anyone else. Mm. And who couldn't find any traces of the revolution they and their husbands had devoted their lives to. So this, my story, is a story of this grand movement that was communism, Bolshevism, and stories of families that in some ways burned in the fire of the revolution as they lived their lives inside their homes with their neighbors, with other Bolsheviks as neighbors, with their families, poor relations, nannies, servants, and of course those children who would grow up to be loving children but not communists.
Wasn't the House of Government sort of wryly referred to as the House of Preliminary Detention? Because you go there, and then, as you were just saying, 800 men kicked out of the house.
Men and women,
Men and women. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, I'm trying to remember, as those people are kicked out, are those apartments, those spaces, are they filled in by other people? And you're nodding yes. And that the people who are then assigned those apartments, how do they feel about that, knowing what's happened to the person who was there before?
Some of them were certainly concerned. It was during the period of mass arrests in 1937 and 38. It was tremendous turnover. People were moving in, arrested, being escorted out, new families moving in. Not many people were frightened, or not as many as we would perhaps have expected, because they considered themselves innocent, and thought that those people who were being escorted out must have done something terrible. Mm-hmm. But since they hadn't, and yet that knock on the door would come, and it would be their turn. And some of the people who had remained next to Stalin in the Kremlin, looking at that huge gray building across the river, would fall from grace and would move across the river into the House of Government, in effect into that house of
preliminary detention
for a short period of time before being arrested. Perhaps some of you listeners know Bukharin, the great Bolshevik ideologue. He was arrested in the Kremlin, but his family was sent to the House of Government before they were arrested, and that is true of quite a few people. So there was this great morbid, sort of macabre migration happening.
So in the little bit of time we have left, you've mentioned several times during the interview that the House of Government is still standing in Moscow. What is it now? Do people still live there?
Yes, it's still a residential complex.
For public officials?
An apartment building for whoever can afford to live there. That constructivist straight lines, large windows are not as popular as they used to be. That were style from the avant-garde style, mm-hmm, from the 1920s. Mm-hmm. But it's popular enough, and you need a lot of money to live there, unless you were among those whose parents or grandparents actually survived the purges, and you are still living there.
God, like a rent-stabilized apartment from generation to generation.
And it's not just so for your listeners, it's known as the House on the Embankment. To most Russians, know it as the House on the Embankment after a novella written about it in the 1970s.
So now the House on the Embankment is it sounds like a ritzy place. Is there a giant Mercedes-Benz logo on the top of this building?
It used to be. They have just taken it down.
And this was huge. It was several stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Incredible. And could be seen from far away around Moscow.
But not anymore.
Not anymore.
I've been speaking with Yuri Sleskin, professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is The House of Government, A Saga of the Russian Revolution. Tonight at 6:30, he will be speaking with novelist Amor Towles at Cooper Union. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Professor, thank you very much for being here. Congratulations on your book. It is an enormous book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.